Brian, I'm a block away.
Where the fuck are you, man?
I told you there was a delay on the A train. Some fucking guy pulled the brake.
Maybe you should have gotten here earlier. AJ's been here for a half hour.
I'm almost there. I'm telling you, I'll be there in like 10 seconds.
Up. We can't keep waiting.
You won't be waiting.
We're already running late.
Is that John?
I've been working on stuff. You know that, Brian. Look, I'm walking up to your door right now. You hear that? You hear the fucking buzzer?
Yeah, I got it. The buzzer doesn't work. I tell you every fucking time. Okay.
Look who decided to show up, the king of podcasting himself.
Fuck you, man. I was on the train. Brian should have told
you
that.
He did tell me. Are you okay? You look
like
shit.
Oh, now it's my fucking fault that you're late? I haven't been able to reach you in, what, 3 days?
I'm fine. I was busy recording. What the fuck are you talking about?
Was there an MP3 I missed or something?
Yeah, an MP3 that we never got.
I got it. It's here. It's on this USB drive. I didn't have time to post in fucking Slack. Look, Brian, I'm
telling you. No, you don't. I'm telling you, we can't keep doing this. Not every week.
I'm telling you guys, I've been working on ideas for the show, something that'll take us to
the
next level.
You've been saying this for 6 fucking months.
Look, man, you can tell us. If you're going through it, just tell us what's going on.
Fuck you, I'll tell you. Can we just start rolling?
Fine. Let's... Where's my fucking mouse?
So many possible worlds, but we got this one. So many possible worlds.
Welcome to the Worst of All Possible Worlds, the first and only podcast where the hosts cut each other off. I'm the worst of all possible Josh.
I'm the worst of all possible AJs.
I'm the worst of all possible motherfucking Bryans, and this is how I win.
That's
this is how
right,
you win.
Brian. No, we're here this week for yet another case study in the pop culture of a dying empire, finally talking about something fucking good for once.
Uncle Jones!
I had so much anxiety doing that opening sequence, and I think that's perfect for this movie. That
really,
gives me
you're able
but
to
anxiety.
Channel it right into your performance.
Oh,
there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Good.
I mean, there's a great sense memory I have watching this movie because for a lot of people, this was the last movie that we saw before COVID-19
right,
shut
yeah.
everything
right, right.
down.
Correct.
I saw it with AJ.
Yeah.
AJ still went on to see Cats.
Yes. for a third time.
Which I did not do. And Josh, you didn't see it because you don't see movies.
No, but the funny thing is, these were Cats and Uncut Gems were actually the first two movies that I watched at the beginning of the pandemic.
The Two Horsemen. Yeah. No, and the thing is, like,
I always forget you saw Cats.
We were talking about Uncut Gems, and we liked Uncut Gems. And like, if I ever mentioned it, Josh, you would just say, "Hey, get this, Uncut Gems."
Yeah, that's true.
Which I think was somebody, some joke that a guy made on Twitter.
Yeah, I think it was Will Menaker or something.
And you just said Uncut Gems.
Oh, that's so deeply infuriating.
And then you see Uncut Gems, and you do not shut the fuck up about it.
Of course not.
It was your Top Gun. It was your Top Gun Maverick of 2020.
Yeah, every year I have one movie. In 2020 it was Uncut Gems.
It wasn't Avatar 2.
Well, and 2022 was Maverick. What was 2021?
I don't remember what 2021 was, but 2020.
No one remembers 2021.
2023 could be Avatar 2. We'll see.
Oh.
We'll see.
Oh.
Uncut Gems. I think the reason, well, I've wanted to do an episode about this for a while.
Yeah.
Because, listeners.
Shut the fuck up.
Josh did not shut the fuck up about this movie. Understandably so.
Yes.
More like Uncut Gems.
It is more like that. It is actually a lot more like that.
I'm mad at myself for saying it. Like,
good.
I can't
good.
Imagine.
But because obviously on this show, a lot of the time, the things that we talk about are movies that peer into the reactionary mind in a way that is harrowing to witness.
Yeah. We're usually talking about stuff where it's like, the way that it's bad is interesting.
Yes.
There's an interesting thing to dig into the badness.
Here, the thing that makes Uncut Gems such an interesting movie is that it is a very well-made movie about a really horrible fucking guy.
Yeah.
And that is a lot of why this movie had such a strongly divided critical reception, which we'll obviously get to a bit later.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things where this film was so polarizing on its release that when I saw it, I wasn't expecting to love it as much as I ended up doing.
I wasn't expecting to love it when I saw it. Like the trailer left me feeling like, okay, they're it's really grainy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, which you maybe don't see it like when you're streaming it or whatever, but like they shot it and overlaid it in a way that gave it this really, really thick film grain.
Yeah. Some grindhouse kind of stuff.
And it was like, okay, I see that they're doing a thing here. It's trying to be really, really realist and really gritty, which is not necessarily my avenue.
They do go to Philly.
And that's true.
Very gritty.
And it was like Adam Sandler, maybe being good again. Who knows?
Right.
Yeah.
And so I was not that
thrilled. It was hard
to
tell from the trailer.
And some people loved it. And AJ was like, let's go see this. And I was like, fine. Yeah, people are talking about it.
Yeah.
And I was blown away.
Yeah.
It's just good storytelling.
Yeah,
you know?
It's so good. It's something that obviously did take 10 years to finally like get to the big screen. And so they had a lot of time to refine it, like perhaps a gem of some kind.
Hey, there we go.
But main memory I have.
They made some cuts.
They did. They did make some cuts. They wrote a screenplay that was 160 pages long.
Oh, wow.
When they, you know, gave it to their producers, they were like, you know, this is going to be a 90-minute movie. And they were like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is 160 pages. And like, well, it's going to have the spirit of a 90-minute movie. And like, what the fuck does that mean?
Which
they're already
shooting
it. It's a 2-hour and 15-minute movie. And I didn't realize that. I was like, oh, maybe this is about 2 hours. It's longer than 2 hours. And it does not. It feels like a 90-minute movie.
It fucking flies. Yeah. So I remember seeing this movie with Brian in the theater. And this movie is a 2-hour and 15-minute panic attack.
Yes.
Yeah. When people ask me, what is it like to live with anxiety? I point them to this movie because it really is. Imagine living your life where you can't ever just focus on one thing, but you have to be doing 9 different things that stress you out all at the same time.
Yeah.
That's the exhaustion you feel from living with anxiety.
Yeah. When I, you know, in 2019, I got a really bad case of shingles in my face and on my head. Led to nerve damage that just meant my head would just fucking itch always, forever, for months. Mm-hmm. And by the time we saw that movie, I had thought it was kind of over with. I didn't have any more of that. And then we got like 2/3 the way through the movie and I got the old shingle tingle
on my
scalp. I was like, oh no. Like, I was just like, it was so, I mean, it was like, it's like No Country for Old Men, right? It's this kind of movie that just like kicks you in the balls.
Yeah.
And you're like, what the fuck is happening? Like, you can't let go.
Yes. Well, AJ, you have some more information about like the history of how this movie sort of got made, right? Like how this panic attack came to be.
Yeah, well, it was a 10-year long panic attack, which I feel like I am at the beginning of the third year of that ever since the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I'll be done by 2030. But so the brothers...
Just like the Great Salt Lake.
Oh.
Hey.
So the brothers Safdie, Benny and Josh, in 2009 came up with this idea. They wanted to do a movie that was vaguely based around their dad's time working in a jewelry shop in the Diamond District of New York.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
So here's an exact quote about that. Our dad, who was a runner and a salesman who worked for an eccentric guy who was trying to constantly earn his place. They were mini pulp stories and absurdly funny. This is from How the Safdie Brothers and the Scribe Ronald Bronstein Took a Decade to Carve Out Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
For Deadline by Anthony D'Alessandro.
Oh, carve out uncut gems. I get it. Yeah, I get it.
Hey, they made some cuts.
And basically, they were nobodies. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Right.
No, these guys really came up, and they were just making stuff. And one of the things... And they're like podcasting and radio guys. They were doing sports radio shows that no one listened to.
Right.
And they did stunts, you know? They did, like, these really wacky things. And they'd find people that, you know, went viral or whatever, like that really short guy who yells at the trumpet player on the sidewalk and starts telling him that he's like a plague to art.
Go to a studio and rehearse. Maybe something you'll learn. You suck. You're a no talent piece of shit. You're a post you like to tell you know that anybody graduate you want to do it or not.
They made a movie with him in it. Like they find these people on the street who are interesting and then they just start doing stuff with them.
In a way, it kind of reminds me of Tim and Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a slightly different aesthetic, but the way that they just are drawn in casting toward these people with very unusual energy.
And this is also very true of like the early neorealist point in Italy where they really would just like cast people off the street. Many cases they weren't recording sound on sets, they were going to dub them anyway. So if it was someone who was a bad actor, like in Bicycle Thieves, who he's a wonderful actor, but I guess they didn't like the way he talked, they just got a different actor to dub his voice for the entire movie.
Wow.
Safdies don't do that. They get in the grit and they just have everyone embody whatever character they're supposed to be.
Yeah, and apparently it's a very egalitarian set. One of the ways they described it is like they would bring in these like real life jewelers to like work with Sandler, and like, we've never acted before, and it's Adam Sandler. Like, we have to bring our game. And Sandler's like, well, I have to bring my game.
Yeah, he was so scared.
Right,
like,
he was so nervous.
Scared about being, like, authentic around these guys who were the real deal. And, like, that's the thing between, like, an Italian neorealist thing where it's, like, all just, like, people they found on the street versus something like this where it's not just people they found on the street and trained actors. There's fucking famous people. And to get all of those, and then also famous people playing themselves.
Yeah.
To get all of those elements working together like this, it does not make sense to me. I don't know how people pull something like this off.
Yeah. That's also a pretty big difference from their other major feature film, Good Time, where obviously Robert Pattinson is famous, but he's not famous in the way that Adam Sandler is famous, right?
Like, right.
Maybe at this point now, your average Joe maybe knows who Robert Pattinson is, but like, it's not fucking Mr. Deeds, you know?
Yeah, right. It's not someone, it's not someone
Billy Madison.
Yeah.
That an adult, that especially an older guy would think anything of
because he
did Twilight movies a long time ago.
Well, and the reason Sandler comes onto this project is because of Good Time. I have a very funny story because I don't think we'll ever cover Good Time on the podcast. And I do want to talk about how Robert Pattinson got to be in that movie, because without Robert Pattinson, we don't have Uncut Gems.
Sure.
So I think we should take a little time to talk about this. This is from The Guardian. Those who know them, the Safdie brothers, say they have a special kind of magnetism for madness. The filmmaker Ron Bronstein, a frequent collaborator, has said that Josh in particular can't move 5 inches through life without attracting a lunatic experience. Such as, for example, that time at the height of the Twilight hysteria when Robert Pattinson sent them an out of the blue email begging them to let him work on whatever their next project was.
Oh, hell yeah.
They could not believe he had ever even seen their low budget heroin drama 2014's Heaven Knows What. The extra layer of oddness to the story is that Pattinson hadn't seen the film. He was going on purely some sixth sense reaction he had to a still of its star, Ariel Holmes's pink lit face.
Huh.
So Pattinson sees a photo still from this movie and is like, put me in whatever the fuck you want to going forward.
Wow.
That's from a Guardian article called Good Time Directors, The Safdie Brothers. Robert Pattinson was just a guy chasing work by Hermione Hobie, which we'll link in the description. But it seems like these guys just have a way of existing in the real world and finding the cool little like nooks and crannies and bringing it out for like a live audience to see. It's remarkable.
They just embedded themselves in the Diamond District for years and years and years and years. Yeah. They just watched how these guys worked, but they had the elements there. They had like, they wanted there to be a basketball player who was a real basketball player playing himself.
Yes.
They wanted to have a gambler who was chasing after money that he did not have. And they wanted it to be in the Diamond District. And all of that has remained intact all the way through the story, even if the exact details of those things have changed.
Yeah, and the basketball player was originally going to be Amari Stoudemire from the Knicks, because although he grew up Baptist, he always felt a strong connection to the Jewish faith, ended up converting to Judaism.
Oh, he's a convert. I knew that they said that he was Jewish. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe he had a Jewish parent. Okay.
No, and what's really wild about him, too, is his affinity for the Jewish faith was originally because of the fucking black Hebrew Israelites.
Oh, of course.
But then he like actually went to Israel and like learned about what Judaism really is and felt such a strong connection to it that he converted.
And so they open the movie with this prologue in Ethiopia among Beta Israelites.
That's actually when the movie hooked me.
Yeah.
Is because I wasn't expecting to just see Adam Sandler like wandering around the Diamond District and all of a sudden we start in fucking Ethiopia.
Yeah, it's fall 2010, according to the little subtitle card. Yeah. We are in the Welo Mine in Ethiopia.
It's 6 p.m.
It is. You know, it's funny that this movie and Left Behind actually take place at the same time.
Crazy.
But unlike Left Behind, this immediately fucking draws us into the action.
An
the scene is
scene.
Wild.
This is directed with the same sensibility as everything else, but it's in just a totally different environment. So they just put you right in to absolute chaos.
Yeah.
You have injured miners. You have like these guys are going and they're digging up these black opals.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is also very interesting. You say that it's you know, it's so similar to the rest of the movie, and that's because they didn't use a second unit, and it's harrowing. You see this man's leg bones sticking out of his leg.
And another thing that this does so smartly, I think, is that it is already acutely aware of sort of the class dynamic that's going on here.
Sure.
You have these miners who are, you know, they're filthy. They've been down in the mines.
They're dressed, you know, they don't have protective clothing.
No.
They're dressed in just plain like linen.
But then the supervisors, they actually do have helmets and other PPE and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Whereas the people down in the mines are clearly like Ethiopians. Many of the supervisors appear to be like Chinese or, you know, so there's sort of this also effect of, oh, there is some global capital here at play
Globo-homo.
In these mines.
Yeah, that's going to follow throughout because it turns out that Howard, Adam Sandler's character, only even knows about these mines, even though he's a diamond dealer. He only knows about these like opal mines and shit because he watched like a Discovery Channel documentary on Beta Israelites.
Yeah.
And then learned about the mines and then got into this whole thing. But yeah, we get out of this prologue. And we find ourselves up Adam Sandler's ass.
Yeah.
It's so good. The way that they make this transition between, because what they do is they zoom in on this gem.
A couple guys
have gone back down in the chaos to basically procure a gem not so legitimately.
Yeah, these guys
right?
are not like miners. The guys who grab this stuff are thieves of some
they
sort.
They are opal
right?
thieves. We get this really cool shot where we zoom in on the gemstone and then it goes through these like weird clouds and fractals and shit like that.
Yeah, so it takes us inside the gem.
Well, yeah, because they talk about a little bit later on, Sandler describes like how you can see like the very beginnings of the universe inside the opal because that's how old they are. And I think that's like, you know, Joyce has that quote about James Joyce. I've read Ulysses.
Big deal. I've read The Power Broker.
Yeah,
it's true. It's longer.
Yeah, but AJ has read Finnegan's Wake. So
that's
he's
true.
The most annoying of us.
I am the most annoying. It's the universal and the specific. And that's what this movie is. I reckoned a lot with this opening shot of what it means to dive into this gem and then suddenly be inside a man's asshole.
Yeah.
And it's a funny bit. I think it's a very good bit, but it is also very telling that like, if you focus in, like laser focus in on any one particular life, you're going to see at least a part of you reflected in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Diamond District is very ignored, even as a New Yorker.
It's really wild walking through it, too, because it's just so like it really still feels like a whole other world.
Like, and I don't even know if I've been to the Diamond District myself because nothing ever takes me to the east side of Manhattan.
Right.
Which is just a strange, empty, haunted world where nothing happens. It is the definition of the heat death of the universe.
Yeah.
There is nothing. It is Azathoth. It is brainless and eyeless. It watches you and yet it watches nothing.
Right, but in that heat, you throw some coal in there, you know what you get.
What?
Diamonds, baby!
Right. AJ, the heat death means there's no more heat! That's what heat death is!
Yeah, because the diamonds took it off.
Stop!
We meet Howard.
Yes, and we are in New York City, spring 2012. Let's just talk about Howard real quick.
Yeah.
What drives him? Who is he? What's his deal?
He's got a real bad gambling addiction.
Yes.
he is a manipulator. He's a guy who is able to talk his way pretty much out of every situation, just like springing in between being extremely mad, extremely joyous at any given moment. Like he can like turn his emotions on a dime.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's the greatest performance Adam Sandler's ever given.
He's high energy in the way that he always is, but the whole movie is at this pitch. The thing that's so interesting about like the Diamond District and about these diamond dealers in New York is like this is high end shit. This is very, very expensive stuff. They're moving every day, but it's not fancy. It's not classy. It's not legitimate.
Right. The Furby.
It's shrouded in secrecy.
Yeah.
It's this whole process of the way things that are done that makes you feel like, I don't know, you're at a pawn shop in downtown Albuquerque,
right?
Everything is bulletproof. Everything is covered up. Everything is cluttered. Everything just kind of looks like shit, honestly. And yet these are things that he's pushing. He's moving products that are like $200,000.
Right.
Like a fucking Furby that's covered in real diamonds.
Yeah. Well, and to the point of how Howard is just such a mercurial guy and how he's such a fast talker and how he can do these things, that's what's sort of necessary to survive in this trade. Because it's all about negotiation. It's all about, you know, not letting somebody get one over on you.
Yeah, this is the reality of the business. And I feel, especially like, as people who grew up in places that are not New York, and as people who grew up as like white Catholic Protestant peoples, there is a certain respectability to our fancy things that does not acknowledge the reality of the supply chain, not just the hideousness of the mining, but also just every part of the way being a haggle, being a deal, being a hustle.
Yeah.
We think of things, it's easy, especially in America, to think of things as just like, well, it's on the shelf. It costs this much money.
Yeah.
This is how it goes. Service with a smile. We're all happy here. And this is all about the game all the time.
Everything
is a crap table.
And that's what makes it such a delightfully distinctive New York City movie.
Yeah. Like New York City.
That's right, AJ. It just really, it feels so authentic to the experience of what happens when you're out somewhere and maybe you're a little bit out of your element, but you need to talk to somebody to get something done.
Right.
These conversations are not conversations I was used to having growing up either. Howard is talking on the phone with some guy. Clearly he's needed for some reason, but he's just going through his day. He steps into this jewelry store that he owns. He promptly gets fucking slapped because he owes a man named Arno $100,000. And there are enforcers in his store who have come to collect the debt.
This movie feels like a play in a lot of ways,
Like
the main inciting incident has already happened by the time we meet Howard, and then we're just seeing it sort of unravel in real time. I mean, you could never do this as a play because there's just too many locations, and like the feeling of New York, I think, is very necessary for it. But like a way that a lot of the scenes play out feels like a mammoth play that you don't have to feel guilty about watching.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And also,
I don't feel guilty about watching Mammoth. I just think I could be anywhere else.
That's true. And you want to be sucked into this world because it really
it sucks you off.
Hey there, you are listening to a preview of a premium episode of The Worst of All Possible Worlds. If you'd like to listen to the rest of this, head on over to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/worstofall. And you can listen to not only the rest of this episode, but our entire backlog of premium episodes, bonus episodes, and if you subscribe at the $10 tier, you will get an extra episode of the podcast every single month. Again, that is patreon.com/worstofall. Hope to see you there.